In the last two or three years, it seems that Sangharakshita has been thinking about the future of the order with a new kind of vigour. And he's been expressing his thoughts through the order members closest to him. Subhuti and Mahamati have both been involved in producing several weighty and not always easily so very digestible papers. Every few months, one of these papers seems to land in our virtual in-trays. First off came What is the Western Buddhist Order? Which called on us all to ask, what's actually what in our order? In it, Bhante defines the order as deriving from him and consisting of the succession of his disciples. However, we define that word. Bhante defines it pretty broadly, saying, inasmuch as they follow my understanding of the Dharma and the general range of practices that I've taught. He said it would be the same for the followers of any Buddhist tradition. It's simple, you just always need to commit yourself to a particular approach and stick to it. You've got to have confidence in it for that to work for you, so that you can give it all that you've got. That's how it works. So we were reminded in no uncertain terms that ours is an order that expresses Bhante's particular approach to the Dharma. That is, especially Pratichasamutpada, and stemming from that, the Four Noble Truths, the 12 or 24 Nidanas, Nirvana, Anatman, and Shunyata. Those are the terms in which he describes it in the paper. And so this, our own tradition, in the end, boils down to a certain atmosphere, a certain approach that can't easily be defined, but that atmosphere and approach comes out of our practicing these teachings together. And in this paper, he also set some limits, saying, for example, that there could come a point where disagreement with him on significant issues could take order members too far outside their relationship to him as teacher. He doesn't define that, but he just puts that down as a kind of a way of looking at it. So he doesn't want blind followers, but nor does he want his students to not take his teachings that seriously or not think carefully about them. Most order members he knows do take him seriously. So he simply wants us to be loyal to the order that we're in and ourselves to know clearly where our hearts lie. Another suggestion in that paper was that we evolve ways to incorporate new teachings into the body of our teachings. Finding satisfactory ways to assess the value of fresh teachings and to accept them harmoniously won't be easy. But it's an important principle for our future, I feel. You know, I feel it's a significant move that means he doesn't see our teachings as a closed book. It's just that if we're to extend or add to them, we must have a proper process for doing that. Now, these ideas, when they came out a while back, they weren't easy for a lot of us to think about and assimilate, and at first there was quite a bit of controversy. But all that is starting to seem like it happened quite a long time ago, because so much has changed in the wake of that paper. Previously, all kinds of questions were flying about regarding our authenticity. I mean, they were all good questions to ask. You know, are we a genuine order? You know, do our teachings work? Etc. But I think Bhante's paper, What is the Western Buddhist Order?, addressed all that pretty well. And I think it landed on us at a time when actually things had started to look better. The order was starting to look as though it contained more mature practitioners, you know, this very diverse and experienced range of men and women that we have in the order. And around that time too, I remember all kinds of issues being raised about our central institutions and decision-making processes. And these issues we are, to some extent, still addressing. But they arose in the first place, I think, because, again, the level of maturity and responsibility in the order had become considerably stronger. So I think it's a result of that strength that those issues have come up. And over that same period, many of us have been looking at other Buddhist teachers and organisations for all kinds of reasons. By the time that paper came out, I think it must have been clear to those order members, as it was to me, that other Western Dharma organisations have very similar issues and problems to ours. And that we, and from making those kind of comparisons, it seemed clear that we have been addressing those issues and problems and addressing them quite well. So I at least could see much more clearly than before how important it is to create solidarity with our order here and now, and to work with its faults, such as they are, in a constructive way rather than a destructive way. So I think What Is the Western Buddhist Order was very, very well timed. And generally, I don't think we've looked back. I'm making a big generalisation, but I think generally we've not looked back from that moment, even if we're still not totally sure what it means to be a disciple. But that little koan has been put in place, and it will continue, I'm sure, to nag at us. And then after that paper came conversations with Bante. His last word, probably, about the topic of his sexuality that some of us have found so very difficult. I personally found it a very open and refreshing account of Bante's life before the order got going. It really does make fascinating reading about the spirit of those times. And I know it doesn't satisfy everyone's issues with that part of Bante's life, but it's a remarkable set of tales nonetheless. And then, I think it's number three, came revering and relying on the Dharma, in which Bante set out his ideas about right view and his wish to avoid abstractions and metaphysical terms with a new, more expanded vision for Pratityasamutpada, and in particular its expression in the different levels of conditioning forces in the five niyamas. And now four, we have Subhuti's even longer paper, 46 pages, no less, about a totally different non-materialist perspective on reality, about the nature of the imagination, and about our imagination of Shakyamuni, the Buddha, the initiator, and the goal of our Dharma practice. And I want to say, I've been very happy with all these papers. Not at first. In fact, when I initially read the first paper, I thought my time was up. I mean, I might have to leave the order. I really thought that, quite seriously. And then, but then I read it properly. And I grasped what Bante was really getting at. And I realised he was opening things up rather than closing things down. What he had to say eventually became one of the main reasons why I left Spain and decided to come back into things. I have now had my decade of simple living in the wilderness. It's all that is over. You know, before Yashobodhi and I moved to London in the autumn, last autumn, I hadn't lived in a building for 9 years. There were quite a number of reasons why the time had come to bring that way of life to an end. But seeing Bante's eagerness for us to grasp more clearly the nature of the order, and within that understand our relationships to him, to the Dharma, and to each other, that's what really made me want to spend the next bit of my life teaching and connecting more with the movement, and not trying to create the lifestyle of some kind of full-time yogic practitioner. You know, I was sad to walk away from the wilderness, the beautiful wilderness of Ekodharma, but no doubt my time will come again one day. Anyway, coming now to today's talk, there's that bit in Subhuti's paper where he speaks about connection with Tibetan tradition, and Bhante wanting us to make a decisive break with Tibetan tradition in relation to sadhana meditation. And this issue arises in the present context because all the sadhanas we have are associated with that tradition, because they were received from teachers who practiced in that tradition. Well, in fact, none of the sadhanas Bhante was given, as far as I know, are actually from Tibetan tradition, despite having been given in that context. All of them were practiced in India long before the period when the final form of Indian Vajrayana Buddhism began to transfer itself to Tibet, where it was preserved over centuries in the timeless realm that existed on that vast and inaccessible plateau of Tibet. There isn't, I'm told anyway, there's not really much in present-day Tibetan Buddhism that is exclusively Tibetan. Some of it is, of course, but it is mostly a faithful reproduction of the various forms and philosophical views of the older Indian tradition as that was in the final period at Nalanda. And when Sangharakshita received initiation in Kalimpong from the great master Jamyam Khyentse Chokyi Lodro, there was no question of his joining the Nyingma order or even becoming a Tibetan Buddhist in any real sense. He was always, seems to me, always a kind of an outsider. Even his ordination as a bhikkhu in the Theravada tradition seems a bit like that. You know, that gave him a useful context and a good support, not only for his practice as a Buddhist, but as someone looking very closely at the Buddhist scene. You know, he was one of a very small number of European practitioners. You have to take your mind back to like 1950-something. And this was long before there was to be any real appreciation of Buddhism in the West. He was in a phase of gathering his own practice together in a context that included, at least this is my intuition, the needs of the West. Even though he had no conscious plans to return at this stage, he was editing Buddhist journals and publications that he knew were drawing an interest in the Western world. So he was in relationship to the West, using the networking channels of his time. And his teachers were perfectly happy with that, with him being that. They knew very well that what they were passing to Bhante would be going outside their tradition. They were very pleased about that. By their behaviour, they obviously felt he was a very suitable vessel for that, and they sincerely hoped the practices would bear fruit, not only for Bhante, but for others too. And one of them, to encourage him, presented Bhante with a tanka, showing him as the recipient of the lineage of teachers of that particular practice. And the lineages of teachers on this tanka include Indian siddhas like Jitari and several Shakyapa, Nyingma, Kadampa and Gelugpa teachers, plus Milarepa. But being a recipient of such a diversity of lines of influence doesn't entail that one carries on that particular line in any preset way. You know, despite the connection with Milarepa, Bhante never became a Kagyupa. The connection with Milarepa is real, and it doesn't go away, can't go away, but it's what one does with that that's important. And what Bhante did with it was simply continue to practice, as he gradually moved towards setting up a movement in the West. And this means that we in the Triratna order founded by Bhante have never been part of a Tibetan tradition in any sense, even though the methods we inherit from it have been continually practiced within our own context. To be part of a particular spiritual tradition means being intimately involved with it, as people are within our own tradition here, and as Tibetan Buddhists are with their tradition. So what, it's interesting to ask, you know, what's meant by this intimate involvement? Well, I've had a bit of contact with various Tibetan traditions over the years, so I've got a sense of what it means to them. In the early, more free-form days of the Vajralokha community, we once, all of us, went and stayed for at least a week at the main monastery of what is now the NKT, the Manjushri Institute at Ulverston, which was then under the auspices of the Western Gelugpa organisation, the FPMT, you know, headed by Geshe Kelsang. And also, over the last 15 years, I've had quite a bit of contact with the Longchen Foundation and what eventually became the Awakened Heart Sangha, Shenpen Hukum's group, who are connected to the Nyingma and the Kagyu orders. There have been various other connections with Tibetan groups, and in all these instances, I've been impressed by the richness the Tibetans can draw on. This is what really strikes me in those connections. You know, apart from the wealth of esoteric teachings, there are just so many connections with experienced teachers. And at all these places, there were always new teachers coming through from India or Nepal, doing their rounds, and each teacher with their particular dharma, specialization, personality, and, you know, strictures. But of course, so there's all this richness, which comes from the fact that it's been going for a very, very long time. But of course, communication was always severely limited, always depending on translation, and with comparatively little dialogue, if that was encouraged at all. And often, to my mind, comparatively little understanding on those teachers' parts of the sensibilities of people they were talking to. It's rather like us going to India, say, and teaching. You know, it's something some of us actually get into sometimes. We're going to be translated. Almost end of story, you know. We'd have a certain idea of what we're doing, but we tend to rely on the translator's sense of the best way of putting things. We can only rely on the good qualities of what we're teaching and trust that it's going to make it through the cultural divide. And on a good day it does, or something does, of course. But there are a lot of important subtleties that don't. And then there are all the particular local issues that are hard to see and understand. The attitudes and the ideas local people have about what they're hearing. All this takes a lot, a lifetime of understanding. So I felt those Tibetan teachers couldn't have much chance of finding out how we people are in the complex and peculiar postmodern West. And how different all that seemed from life in the FWBO. The people I was building my life with were certainly complex, but we had only started creating a tradition, and it didn't look much like what they in these Tibetan groups had. Indeed, it's only in very recent years that we've started talking seriously in this way of FWBO or Triratna as a Buddhist tradition. You know, they, the Tibetans, they'd been going, you could say, since the Buddha. Well, so had we, actually. But we hadn't really caught up with ourselves in that kind of a way. We're starting to do that now. We're in a position to do that more now, I feel. I could feel that the people at FPMT were still somehow in touch with what they'd inherited from the ancient Vajrayana tradition. And that translated somehow into a kind of ease and a breadth, a relaxed sense that can only come from things continuing over a long period of time. You know, I'm contrasting things actually in the very early 1980s here, but you know, this ease and breadth, this relaxed sense, it translated into a deep faith, even a somewhat unquestioning faith, a faith that was centered upon the guru. It might have been a bit unquestioning, but it seemed not at all contrived. It seemed quite natural. No one was trying hard to believe in anything. Everyone very easily had faith. The feeling was that since so many great masters, so many great male and female practitioners had become awakened through these methods, that even now they were still practicing, that then surely the result was going to be rich and amazing. That was the feeling I got from this kind of contact. And that ease of faith, I feel, is still something we don't really have as a collective, due partly, I guess, to our emphasis on critical thinking. And maybe that's a good thing, yeah. But I suspect we just need a little more unity, which will come along eventually with more and more experience and richness in our teaching and in the results of our practice. In the past, I've wondered at various times if maybe it's because we don't practice properly, or don't have the right teachings or the right teachers. You know, nowadays I do think we have the right teachings on the whole, and I feel our teaching is getting a lot stronger now. There is much more of a weight of experience. I think it's all happening in the right way. There's plenty we need to do to unify amongst all the different streams of teaching happening at present. But I'm sure in time the various different approaches at centres, you know, from MBSR to Chud, yeah, from 7-point mind training through Tonglen, Anapanasati, you know, all of this will become more integrated together in the long term as we share a deeper and deeper overall experience. So Bhante's paper on what is the order, I feel, has given us a much needed sense of being one movement. And in this paper, his suggestion that we look much more to the historical Buddha Shakyamuni also gives this kind of direction towards unity. We can see it's something we're already doing to a very great extent if we look at what in our collective culture already stems from the Buddha. I don't even know if I need to go through all this, but our practices of meditation mostly come directly from Shakyamuni Buddha. There's the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana, which are taught in great detail in the Pali scriptures. There's mindfulness itself in the Satipatthana Sutta, and that underpins our just sitting meditation. Then meditation on the elements, meditation on death and impermanence, and meditation on conditionality in terms of the 12 and the 24 Nidanas. All this is extensively documented from numerous different angles in the Pali canon. There's the practice of walking meditation and Vipassana, which again is, you get this kickstart in the Satipatthana Sutta, but is much detailed elsewhere in the canon. And reflection on the value of the Buddha, what I was talking about yesterday. Reflection on the value of the Buddha as well as the Dharma and the Sangha is found in many places. For example, in our chanting of the Ti Ratanavandana. The recollection of the Buddha, Buddha Anusati, is a slightly later Theravada tradition, I believe, based on the first part of those verses. but the Buddha encouraged stupas to be erected over his remains so that people could remember and reflect upon him. So these are the seeds of the more developed sadhana tradition in which we remember and reflect, and through that actually connect with the Buddha. So even this comes from the Buddha. And also, I'll go on for a second or two, stemming from the Buddha is the basic framework for our ethical practice, the 10 wholesome actions, the 10 precepts. I could go on, but as I list these things that we've got from the Buddha and start thinking about what to list next, it all starts to get a bit ridiculous, because of course it's really obvious that we're going to find the Buddha at every turn, since we are, after all, a Buddhist movement dedicated to teaching and realising ourselves what the Buddha taught. We've been influenced by so much that we almost can't see him anymore. But the more I look into the Dharma and the Sangha as well, I find the Buddha again. Bhante has reflected, for example, on many of the stories in the canon about the shenanigans that went on in the monastic Sangha of his day. You know, the stories that demonstrate so many points of Dharma that arose. So many principles of meditation and behaviour and spiritual friendship. So to bring his image more alive, we at least need to recognise or recall the extent that we already rely tremendously on our great ancestor, Shakyamuni. And this fits in well with the notion of sadhana as the complete mandala of all our practices, with the yidam at the centre. You know, you've probably heard this idea. You know, you see every practice you do as a facet of the central practice. The sadhana that brings life, that brings to life the yidam, that brings to life the Buddha. Our Dharma lives in the Triratna order already reflect so much that comes from the Buddha. It would be easy, with a bit of reflection, to see him at the heart of everything we're doing. So I suppose this idea of making a decisive break with the Tibetan tradition in the end seems a bit of a non-problem. We may have a personal interest, but as order members, we never have actually been part of it. The sadhana text we have emanated from the older Indian Vajrayana. And the images, I think we largely feel quite free to play with. I don't think we feel that bound by any strictures emanating from Tibetan Buddhism, even though we have certainly learnt a lot about imagery from Tibetan Buddhism, and we can continue to do that. We can relate it to the images, most of us. But if other images come up, we can probably relate to them as well. It's the same with mantras. We've been introduced to the mantras, and they carry, for those who recite them regularly, they carry a great deal of increasingly profound meaning for us. That's not going to go away if we keep that up. But that meaning has built up outside the context of Tibetan Buddhism. So this is another way we are building our own tradition. Making a decisive break with Tibetan tradition seems to mean, at least in part, clarifying that we are not and never have been part of it, and that the practices we do have always existed in their own space. It's a bit like seeing that you're free and then, oh, actually using that freedom. Perhaps some of us are only just noticing that we aren't tied to Tibetan tradition. The rest of the idea of making a decisive break, perhaps, is about making the leap into the world of Shakyamuni Buddha's image. So we can get into this. You know, we can read more about the Buddha, immerse ourselves a bit in the Pali scriptures, read biographies of the Buddha. You know, Visvapani's book is very, very good. And reflect on the Buddha's qualities by studying the Buddha Vandana, the first part of the Triratna Vandana, the Triratna Vandana, or just by thinking about what we've already heard about the Buddha, what we've already taken in. Perhaps though, some of us rather wanted to be tied into Tibetan Buddhism. Perhaps because that might confer a greater sense of authenticity. Or perhaps because they felt that to be too independent is unhealthy. I can relate to this. They felt that to be too independent is unhealthy and would have liked more of a sense that we were working together with other Buddhist groups. I don't see these kinds of reasons as at all compelling now, but I have been very inspired by some other aspects of Tibetan tradition and culture. Now, as a Westerner, brought up in a world that worships scientific achievement and is mediated, and whose life is mediated by a vast array of technology, I found it incredibly refreshing to have contemplated the richness of Tibetan culture, especially as it existed before its fall to the Chinese. And I'm sure this is also the case for many Westerners. You know, it comes across as a perfect example of an indigenous civilization that is spiritually and culturally satisfying for its people in a way that is beautiful and deeply in touch with its own land. In other words, it's all that we don't have. Obviously, it's easy to have a very over-idealized picture, and there's certainly a dark side of Tibetan culture. Nevertheless, the deep faith so many Tibetans show in their appreciation of the Dharma says a great deal about the value that has been instilled by their culture. Tibetan culture seems to have been integrated with the wild, open aspect of nature, to be connected to every level of nature in terms of the five niyamas. Our own culture, we find, is divided and our images broken, as Subhuti says. So, as far as this aspect is concerned, I do believe there is much we can learn from Tibetan and other rich indigenous cultures. We're not part of it, but it has some spirit that we lack, a spirit that we need in order to cultivate an appreciation of the realm of the imagination. The issue of how to live with technology is going to be with us throughout the coming decades, you know, as the oil reserves peter out and it becomes increasingly challenging to sustain a level of comfort and convenience. You know, new technologies may help us adapt to the shift if our societies can remain stable enough to sustain those technologies. It may be that before it's too late, we manage to evolve far less wasteful ways to travel, to warm, and to inform ourselves. But this is, of course, a hope that is based upon fear. For us, prior to that kind of concern, must come the deeper spiritual concerns for there to be awareness, compassion, fearlessness, and wisdom in the world. The Dharma has to come first. In our teaching of the Dharma, it's helpful if we utilize whatever technologies are available, partly as a way to meet the people around us, partly because it's useful. Though there is a dark side, the Dharma can be widely spread and well communicated through the new communications technology. And in our order, there are extremes of adoption and non-adoption of the contemporary internet-based technologies, the phones and the computer devices. You know, we have our fundamentalists who perhaps grudgingly have just about started to use email, and our enthusiasts who always have the latest gadgets and are online, you know, 24 hours a day. You know, along with Mahayana Buddhists worldwide, we, on the whole, generalization, tend to veer towards the latter extreme. But maybe we need to appreciate the fundamentalist view as a more sobering influence. After all, renunciation is an extremely important step in anyone's spiritual progress. So each individual needs to work out to what extent their networks are helpful and to what extent they are just distractions building up the wrong kind of karmic tendency. With technology, there is of course that important issue about alienation and disconnection with the natural world, or from the natural world, like our body. It can leech away our mindfulness. There is clearly something wrong with a culture in which the tiny children are now getting immersed in little screens for hours at a time. But on the other hand, it's the technology that enables us to explore, enjoy and share the arts. You know, in all the rich variety we have nowadays. The technology is, in the end, just technology. And what counts is how we use it. We really need to choose to use it well. There must be some kind of middle way. In seeking a middle way, the old world of Tibet maybe offers us some kind of elemental touchstone. But the main touchstone, as Bhante has now finally pointed out to us, needs to be the Buddha. The Buddha Shakyamuni, whose tradition of awakening we are continuing. It may seem very obvious, but for this, I think Bhante deserves much thanks.